Welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the Markets team.
This week on the show, maybe it's just me, but this week has felt like a month. Stock swings of at least 5% have become the norm, with trading halts going off left and right. Bonds aren't necessarily providing the hedge that they should, and liquidity is being called into question.
It's not just you, Sarah.
Okay, that's good to know. Because I've got to say, I'm exhausted, and I think we all are.
I will say, very often it is just you, I think. In this case, it's not just you. I think the craziest thing I saw in markets, I'm just going to get it out of the way, was everything this week. It was just
There's no avoiding it.
But I have to give an extra special thank you to our guests this week for actually making it out into the world during this this craziness we're seeing and showing up today for the podcast. Returning to the show, Lauren Goodwin. She's an economist and multi-asset portfolio strategist at New York Life Investments. Lauren, if I sneeze, it's allergies, I swear to God.
You know, my allergies are really bad. Every time I have a little tickle in my throat, I'm worried about the social ramifications of clearing it.
Well, in all seriousness, you have to think about if this starts running into hay fever season. I mean, God help us all. So,
you get judged on the side of the street now if you sneeze, if you just look a little bit off.
Yep.
People are judging.
Yes. I'm judging you right now, Sarah. I'm judging everyone. You're all a little suspicious to me. Every microphone I sit in front of, I'm like, wait a minute, who was at this before me? But also joining us on the show, first-time guest on the show, Market Live's own Kriti Gupta. Kriti, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, well, you're welcome. Lauren, let's start with you. Now, you're a strategist and an economist. I feel like the big question is a recession pretty much inevitable right now? I mean, is it a done deal by now?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting the way that you put it. You're a strategist and an economist, but there's no economy and no strategy work with right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, look, I think that one of the really, really interesting things, if we can take a step back from everything that's happening right now, is just how unreliable a signal economic data is going to give us upcoming. So recession, no recession. I mean, look around. It feels almost certain that we will have recession or recession-like circumstances here in the U.S. And even if they're transitory, they could be quite severe. What's going to be really interesting is we're not going to be able to tell what the official read on that is. I mean, you look at the economic data that's come in, an amazing jobs report, for example, last week. Who cares? It was before the virus. Yeah. But also, if you can think to the other side of this, because we will come to the other side eventually, we're not going to trust bad data because it was, from before things got better. And we might get, a really brief, nice, big bang of pent-up demand, but no one will trust that either because it's just the pent-up demand. So I think it's going to be a year before we get a reliable signal from economic data. Doesn't mean that we won't still have useful clues, but recession, no recession. I mean, the biggest indicator I'm using right now is my eyes looking what's going on.
Right, seriously.
And I'll give you a statistic. This week, we put out a story, and it's just some food for thought. Since the S&P 500's inception, there have been 13 bear markets. So 13 times when we fell from a record to below 20%, as we have this week. And in only two of those experiences did a recession not come after. So sure, markets sell off, we get corrections a lot, but it's pretty rare to actually get this 20% bear market and not see a recession. And with that, Lauren, I saw in your notes that you sent over to us, you had a line and you said, buy the dip is dead. And it sure feels that way. We've just had day after day of extreme pressure. But why do you say that? And why do you think we feel that way right now?
I think that one of the really, really interesting developments in markets right now is, or changes perhaps, is just in the last 10 years, we've gotten really used to buy the dip. Just the idea that if you had a really bad week, that there was always a reason to think positively as long as things weren't going really, really badly, right? We've had monetary policy almost always stepping in when we've hit roadblocks, mid-cycle slowdowns. We can always justify markets moving down. Meanwhile, over the course of that 10 years, profit conditions have been decelerating, if not deteriorating. We are late cycle. And so when I'm looking at, you know, let's say 3 weeks ago, valuations are really high. All these late cycle dynamics are in play. We've been defensively positioned in our portfolio for 6 months saying, look, it's probably worth it even if we're a year early, because at some point we'll get a catalyst. I did not know that coronavirus was going to be the catalyst, but I'm not a buyer until I see a real reason for durable upside. And, you know, case volume still rising, credit markets still figuring this out. That catalyst will certainly come, but it's not right now.
Well, it was fascinating on Thursday. You know, so much stress has been centered in the dollar funding markets, as well as the credit markets, but really a lot of stress in the dollar, you know, cross currency basis swap type of thing, which don't ask me to even explain them, but I know there's stress there. Okay, I've have it on good authority that there's stress there, even though I can't quite explain it. And then you see the Fed come out with really this surprise bazooka of $500 billion worth of repo operations, effective the same day and spread out across the curve. So we can finally put that, is it QE or is it not QE debate sort of to bed. I mean, I think this is much more like QE than what they were doing before. And you did see a pop in the S&P 500. It was like 6% off the lows, but then immediately...
Yeah, for 10 minutes.
10 minutes. And then you see headlines from Italy with a dramatic increases of cases and deaths and right back down. And I feel like the government in some ways, the Fed at least, is getting a bad rap because there's only so much they can do. I mean, you can't repair this economic damage with monetary policy right now. I mean, is there, you know, and the same is to some degree, I think, true of the federal government. I mean, they're going to throw everything they can at it, presumably, that we have this really dysfunctional political situation, which might make that impossible. I mean, is just all hope lost, basically, as far as the putting a floor under equities with either monetary or fiscal policy?
No. It might feel that way for another few weeks. And I think that what we will get in the next few weeks is exactly what you're describing. Policy and hopefully in certain cases, really good policy, coordinated policy will reach the market in a way that is positive. And until we see geographic spread and case numbers of this virus decline, it just won't mean anything. And right. I think we actually need both of those things to go right, to start to put a floor. And again, I think it'll take a couple of weeks, if not longer, but we will get there. All hope is not lost. In the short term, though, we're playing this market very tactically. Yeah. It's interesting. Someone asked me earlier today, you know, if you're talking to a long-term investor, what do you tell them? And it's just hunker down. You know, you have to take what you got, and what we have for now is going to be these ebbs and flows. And if you're getting 8% swings within a day, that's what you have to work with. Now, when we do see that decline in case volume, decline in geographic spread, and policy that's meant to sustain that positive outcome, that's when we'll get back into the markets. But it'll probably still be in a really targeted way, looking at cyclicals, for example, to capture that upside. And it might not last long. There's so much uncertainty around right. every element of this market that you've got to play it day by day.
Yeah, everyone's already wondering, well, maybe it will subside a little bit in the summer, but then you have to worry about a reoccurrence in the fall, I guess. Obviously, you know, events last weekend really accelerated this sell-off as far as this oil price war that we've seen. You know, Saudi Arabia came out over the weekend and drastically lowered their selling prices, said they were going to, you know, pump a tremendous amount of oil. Russia kind of responding. Kriti, I wanted to ask you about this. I know you follow this pretty closely. I mean, to me, this feels like a game of chicken between Saudi Arabia and Russia. Is that a good way to look at it? And I got to say, you know, as we get near the end of the week here, it doesn't seem like anyone's blinking. I mean, is there any sign of when this, you know, tremendous price war in oil could sort of end?
Well, this has happened before, and that's what you really need to keep in mind here when you're talking about time frame and this sort of thing. Looking back to 2014, 2015, 2016, when we saw the U.S. shale market really boom and these players overseas face the same fears and have to go and try to flood the market and then cut once again to try to eliminate these players. So I would look to history for that. As far as a time frame goes, it doesn't look like this is going to end anytime soon. Once again, this is that second punch in the 1-2 punch we saw for markets this week. This is really a key as we're going into just kind of an already recessionary period, already seeing demand really drop anyways, and to see this price war potentially last for 2 or 3 months, which is what I'm hearing from strategists and traders, that could change the game.
And it seems like, you know, as you say, the shale patch in the U.S. is just caught in the middle. It doesn't seem like there's anything they can do to punch back. I mean, even President Trump politically, you know, he's got so much else on his plate that how can he push back at both Russia and Saudi Arabia? It just seems like, you know, asking too much, even from someone like him, who's not afraid to mix it up geopolitically.
Right. And when we were seeing these headlines, I believe this really, our colleague Javier Blas over on the energy team actually tweeted this out and said that the real start of this price war was when Energy Minister Novak walked out of the OPEC meeting and said, all OPEC producers are free to pump at will starting April 1st. That was really when all this sparked, really angered the Saudis. And the original reasoning for all of this was to attack the U.S. shale market, which has anyway kind of threatened market share and certainly threatened prices as well. So what we're seeing here is not just a term of kind of we need to flush out the U.S. policy market, but there are geopolitics at play, and the U.S. is still very much a part of it. When those headlines came out, we were expecting a policy response from the U.S., and we didn't get much.
Lauren, what's the effect of this oil price shock actually on the stock market and on the economy? Because, sure, we had the worst day in the oil market since the 1991 Gulf War, but then you think about energy companies as a share of the S&P 500 being at a record low around 3% or so. But also at the same time, don't oil companies make up a pretty large amount of CapEx spending? Like, how do you think about filtering this oil price shock into examining not just the equity markets, but also the economy at large?
Well, we'll start with the economy. This is a net negative for the U.S. economy, period. I think normally when you think about oil prices falling, you think about a boost to the consumer through lower gas prices, especially in the U.S. where lots of people drive. But right now, when economic activity is already under stress from the virus, that positive impact can't really make its way through the way it normally would. If half of us aren't going to work, right, then you don't get that benefit. If you don't have a job, then it's just such a small impact relative to some of the bigger picture things going on. Meanwhile, as you're mentioning, we have the energy sector under stress, especially energy services. This, as you mentioned, is such a sector that's already taken such a beating. You know, of everyone that was struggling before this, energy has had such a hard couple of years. You don't have the business CapEx, you have the drag on confidence, and you have this, depends on the day, but seeming correlation in assets being drawn down that makes the equity market sell-offs feel so much worse. It just, to me, seems like a clear indicator that we won't have the rebound in Q3 that people were hoping for, even if the virus does improve a little bit.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that sort of odd correlations that we're seeing. You know, there's some points during this week where, you know, treasury yields actually started rising off the lows. Gold has been really hit hard. I mean, I guess the sort of easy way to theorize about it is that, again, it's that dollar funding stress. There's margin calls being made, that sort of thing. I mean, is it that simple, do you think? Or, you know, because it really, in a way, feels like markets just aren't functioning the way they should be.
I think it could be that simple. Hindsight will be 2020 on this one. I mean, there's a lot going on. I think not all of these, we talk about cross currents, such strong cross currents. Not everything is going to be a one-to-one, but you have fear, which is, of course, a big sell-off. I think you probably do have some financial deleveraging where investment companies that are under stress are trying to make sales without making a big deal of things. And so you're seeing some of what would normally be uncorrelated assets all move down together. But for example, in Wednesday of this week, that was very much the case. Like the only things that did okay were orange juice, you know, in terms of financial assets. Other days, there has been a little bit more of what we would call normal market activity or normal risk-off behavior. I don't know. To me, it seems that that financial deleveraging piece has to be a part of the story. Otherwise, we would see something consistent across these days.
Orange juice, maybe vitamin C is the, yeah, the haven
exactly,
trade.
Honestly. The other one was cocoa, which, yeah, maybe you're hunkering down and need to feel better about it.
So, Kriti, I'm curious, you read a lot of the research and the news in the oil patch. Is anyone predicting sort of what the bottom in oil prices will be? Or, you know, I know a lot depends on what the sort of break-even price is for the Saudi government's budget and the Russian government's budget. I mean, can we depend on those sort of break-even levels of the budget to act as a floor?
So we've dropped way past those. And what's key here to note is that the Saudis have been really struggling with this. This is why they were trying to bring the Russians and other OPEC members really to the table here, because they need that $80 price level to just balance their budget. And then, of course, for their Aramco IPO as well, that's a big part of the story. The Russians can have a little bit more room to play with here, because 40 is their price limit, 40 to 42, depending on how you calculate. For U.S. shale producers, that number before we hit bankruptcies. Now, remember, the U.S. shale patch is a private kind of sector, not necessarily a state-owned one. So when you're looking at the U.S. shale sector, those numbers were 45, 50. We're way past them. And now the strategists and the traders I'm talking to are saying it could go down as low as $10 a barrel, which really puts all three players in trouble.
So it's a matter of everyone's feeling pain. It's just who can...
Who calls for mercy first. Right.
Honestly, the only saving grace that I see in what's going on in the oil sector is that because we've experienced this rapid decline in oil prices so recently, you know, it's only been 3 or 4 years since we were experiencing this. We've tested these levels a little bit. We know that shale really starts to hurt below $45 a barrel. It's not everybody. The range for U.S. shale is really wide. It's like between 7 and 80 or something where companies are solvent. But that 45 level is really sensitive. We also know which countries start to really hurt. And so I think while that's not good news that those dynamics are coming up again, it is a slightly more known unknown than the virus. I think if we were experiencing this for the first time, like we did 3 or 4 years ago, or first time in sort of recent memory, this would be even feel even more pandemic pandemonium than it does right now.
And then before we get to the craziest thing, I have to ask you, Lauren, about the credit markets, because it did feel like that was where we really saw a large change this week. I mean, you think of Boeing drawing down a full amount of its $13.8 billion credit line, Hilton drawing down its credit line. Then you have the likes of Blackstone and other firms telling their companies to draw down their credit lines too. High yield CDX spreads jumping. I mean, what's the credit market telling you at this point? Is this at the point where people have to truly start worrying more, because we are now seeing some signs of credit stress?
I'd say so. We're not jumping yet from a portfolio management perspective. And when it comes to, are we truly in a credit event? I think we're 3 to 4 weeks away. But what we've seen, and this week was the first time we've started to see that pressure in the public markets, but in private credit and private equity markets, deal flow or the pipeline flow has dried up. It's been a couple of weeks. It makes sense, right? You can't travel to do due diligence. No one's going to lend in this environment when you're not really sure what's going on. And so I think 3 to 4 weeks from now, we'll be looking at companies saying, we're not going to be able to do deal flow until the fall. And that's when we start to be much more concerned about the knock-on effects of this virus to the economy. Because if you can keep credit markets stable and secure, and you can keep small businesses afloat to sort of wade through a couple of months, you're fine. If we're looking at 4 months of stress and 6 months of defaults, then it's a different scenario.
I love how relaxed you said, oh, we're three or four weeks away from from a major credit. Okay. But I do wonder, you know, there's been so many reforms put in place in the banking system. And we also, you know, in the global financial crisis of 2008, the whole credit default swap market was this giant gorilla in the room that had grown, you know, way out of proportion to the point there, you know, there was much more default swaps out on certain types of debt than there was actually the debt. You know, it's like insuring your house for 10 times what it's worth. So I do feel like we've sort of eliminated some of those risks, you know, the banking system, for all the complaints about all the, liquidity requirements and reserves they've had to maintain. I do feel like, you know, they're in a better shape to handle a stress. I don't think anyone had ever stress test for exactly what we're being faced with. I mean, when do we start worrying about the banks?
You know,
like five or six weeks.
My father called and asked me this question this morning, which I think is perhaps telling.
Yeah.
Really interesting because, you know,
we were on the same wavelength.
Well, that's not what I meant.
They're the only people who laugh at my jokes.
But he's all in this podcast. Yeah. Right.
No, but he said, look, I have X number of months of payroll in the bank. I was feeling really good about that. Do I need to be really worried about that? And I think because of the regulations that have been put into place, the answer to that question is probably not. I think that the banks are in a really good spot.
Right.
Now, what that regulation has done is shift some of that activity into the private credit markets, which is why we're monitoring that space so closely.
Right,
so where you did have leverage in the banking system, now you have leverage in private credit and private equity. Now, that doesn't mean every private equity or private credit provider is in bad shape. Quite the contrary. If you've been investing all along in perhaps, you know, sectors that are less cyclical or less vulnerable to shocks or just definable value creation, then this is probably okay because those aren't going to be the companies that lose all of their cash flow and default in 2 months.
Right.
Companies that were struggling to create that cash flow in the first place, that's where you start to have defaults rise. And so it's not going to be every credit provider out there, but that leverage has shifted outside of the banking system to other areas. That's where we need to be focused on from a crisis perspective.
All right. Sarah, what is the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
I have to say the craziest things that I have seen this week were just all the trading halts. I mean, I'll get all my days straight here, but Sunday night futures go limit down. Monday night futures go limit up. Then we have a cash trading circuit breaker on Monday. Then Wednesday night futures go limit down. Then Thursday we have another circuit breaker in the cash trading session too. And it's just been nonstop. And it's crazy because these huge, huge moves have become such the norm. And for me, I mean, over the weekend, the last weekend, I was the one who had to sit around on Saturday and prepare a story just in case futures actually traded limit down, not thinking they actually would. And then Sunday night, I was in working and helping cover Asia TV when they did go limit down. And it was all really just so surreal. And I think it was just really eye-opening as to what we were truly in for this week.
Yeah, I'd say it'd be interesting for someone to study, you know, if these circuit breakers helped in any way. I mean, at some point, when the market is actually acting rationally, a rational response to just a very irrational situation, it is a surreal feeling. All right, that's pretty good, Sarah. I'll give you high points for that one.
I couldn't avoid it.
Creedy, how about you? What do you have?
So oil has been my big one, seeing almost a 50% decline in oil prices and then trading sideways in oil for the rest of the week just on any potential news out of the Saudis and the Russians, despite those kind of limit downs, limit up news that Sarah was talking about. And of course, the Fed and all those repo operations, oil not budging after that massive move.
That's pretty good, too. That's pretty good. Lauren, are you come prepared?
Did I warn you?
I have high hopes for yours.
So this has been a week where I'm not even asking, could that number be real when I flip through numbers on my iPhone? It's just everything's crazy. One of the things that y'all mentioned on the podcast last week is that, look at Purell on Amazon or whatever, and it's $300. A white belt, just like Lukawa wears, $7.99.
I'm gonna love this.
$7.99?
$7.99 can be yours.
That seems about $7 overpriced.
Right?
But
that's the craziest thing I've seen in the market this week, that it costs so
much. No one wants belts, or maybe more people want white belts a la Lukawa, more than we expect.
So obviously that belt was priced lower before the podcast, and so you have boosted demand for white belts.
Amazing. I think you win craziest thing of the year with that one. That is
easily.
You gotta love the paying attention to the podcast and the and poor Luke, he's not here to defend himself, but that's all right.
This is gonna make his month, though.
That is fantastic. Yes. And Sarah, remind the people about our hotline. If they've seen something crazy in the markets, they can call us. Do you have that number?
I have that number handy as always. You can always give us a call. That number is 646-324-3490. And if you've seen anything crazy in this last week, because we're all sure that you have, or you have any questions, feel free to leave us a message and maybe we'll play it on the show.
Absolutely. And feel free to call and tell us the craziest thing you saw Luke Kawa wear, too. That's acceptable. Let me give you a couple tweets from some of the listeners about the craziest things they've seen this week. One guy at, I'm assuming it's a guy, at TJ Beller on Twitter. Craziest thing he saw is that almost two-thirds of all high-yield energy issues are now trading at 1,000 basis points over U.S. Treasuries. That is pretty amazing. So two-thirds of the junk energy complex is trading at a full 10 percentage points above Treasuries. And then we had a couple requests from some other longtime listeners. The head of the Chris Nagy fan club, Eli Panami, wrote in to say, better yet, what has been sane this week? And then a response came to him from JY Squall at Twitter. Yeah, maybe this week it would be different to do what went fine good in the market. We got nothing for you guys. I'm sorry.
Don't forget the orange juice.
The orange juice. That's pretty good. Yeah. Buy orange juice,
I will
I guess.
Say, I have one other thing. There's a Dow Jones long short market neutral portfolio of quality stocks having its best streak since 2009.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So something.
Yeah. Well, finally, the long short hedge funds are having their day, I guess.
Yeah. Not too much great in the market. Hopefully by next week, maybe we can share some positive things for you.
I hope so.
Yeah. But with that, hopefully things are looking up from here. But Lauren Goodwin, Kriti Gupta, thanks so much for coming on the show today. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and Kriti Gupta is at Kriti Gupta News. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.